and I teach religion at St. Olaf College. I also had a approximately 45-second pregnancy. It was a very quick labor.
Yeah, you saw my picture? Yeah. My wife is here. She's actually pregnant. So that's
We're going to fix a technical glitch that obviously we didn't have time to fix because the power was out. But we can still begin. And you are sitting along with me on a voyage to talk about bioethics. And I appreciate you being here, and I look forward to the conversations we will have over this issue because I think it's an important issue. Most of you have probably heard of the Human Genome Project and all the advances that people are talking about in terms of what we can do with genetic testing, what we can do when we talk about proteins and cells and genetic diseases like Alzheimer's and diabetes. And part of what I'm tasked to do here today is to lead us in a conversation about something that changes pretty much every year. Every year there, we could even make it even less than every year, there's a rapid number of scientific breakthroughs that sort of challenges our assumptions as Christians. And that's the perspective I'm approaching this question from. A Christian, when I'm Lutheran, ELCA Lutheran, I'm going to do a little bit of sort of broadly reductionistic and simplistic attitudes in terms of the dynamic that we experience as Christians. And that's sort of a fancy mumbo-jumbo way to say that I think we are Christians. We are called to be members of the body of Christ. But none of us are only members of the body of Christ. Hopefully many of you went to Carla's session this morning, which was on pluralism. Pluralism suggests that even though you are Christian, we need to value other perspectives on what's valuable. That means that we have to figure out ways to talk about what we value. At the same time, value other people's perspectives, but also our own. That challenges us as Christians. Luther had this idea of the two kingdoms, in which we are sort of in between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of the princes. And I think most of us feel that. Most of us don't know precisely what to do. And when it comes to bioethics, there's a great deal of ambiguity about what is, let's say, a Christian stance on bioethics, such as euthanasia, genetic testing, genetic modification. What do we do as Christians? At the same time, respecting or understanding that there are numerous different perspectives on, let's say, good bioethics, if I can use that term. Bioethics literally means the customs of life. The way we use it in our culture, it has to do with a clear focus on what we value in the physical being, our bodies, our physical material self. It's a very young discipline, partially because medicine as we know it is pretty young. It's only within the last 200, 250 years that we can actually say that medicine has entered into its own as a legitimate practice. Before, it always had spiritual connotations. In fact, the earliest doctors, I'm a doctor, my joke with my wife is that now I'm a doctor, I can deliver her baby. But most of you would laugh, right? Because I suppose I could, it might be a bad delivery. But originally, doctors, priests and pastors were doctors of the soul. And the belief was that the soul itself was the cause of physical ailments. So how did you help people? Well, you help them by recognizing their guilt. You went to confession. And when you confessed, guess what? That unburdened your soul, unburdened your spirit with the belief that your physical being would be healed. In fact, the root of salvation. Anyone know the root of salvation? Or one of the roots of salvation?
Salve.
And what's a salve?
It's a healing thing.
Think of other words that begin with salve. Salvage. Fix something. I got a burn. My mother's here too. This week I'm also sort of an errand boy for the church physician. So. She would put salve when I burnt myself. Same root. Well, today medicine in a lot of ways has taken over the healing arts, something that religion used to do. So, what I'm hoping to do this week is use stories from
the newspaper that deal with bioethical issues that are in the news. And last week, July 24th, there was one in the Seattle Times about an Oregon faith healing couple that was acquitted of manslaughter. So I'm just going to read part of it. Okay. The jury forewoman in the trial of an Oregon couple acquitted of manslaughter in their daughter's pneumonia death says she felt the pair were loving people who didn't mean to harm the 15-month-old girl. The jury knew Carl Brentworth Worthington and his pregnant wife, Raylene, quote, had no intentions of ever harming their child, end quote. Ashley Santos told reporters on Thursday. If anything, the evidence showed the opposite. But the jury did convict Carl Worthington of criminal mistreatment, a misdemeanor for not taking his daughter, Ava, to see a doctor. He faces a maximum of a year in jail when he is sentenced on July 31st. Raylene was acquitted. The Worthingtons are members of a small church that favors faith healing over doctors. During the trial, the defense made a point of noting that in families of the Worthingtons Church, the followers of Christ, husbands make all important decisions. Prosecutors had tried to show the couple's faith led them to deny their daughter medical attention, but the account Santos gave of the deliberations suggested that jurors sympathized with the couple as parents who didn't realize how sick the girl was until it was too late to save her. I'm a parent, Santos said. I don't make perfect decisions every time. So, in summary, there was a couple that belonged to a Christian church who believed that faith would cure their 15-month-old child. And I want to begin there, because I think it's a good way to get into thinking about the sources for Christian bioethics. And with that example, what can we say, or how can we say Christianity influenced their choices regarding the physical health of their baby? Any thoughts? Yes.
Well, it was a particularly narrow interpretation. Would faith bring them success? Would faith bring them money? Would faith bring them, you know, all kinds of things. So it was a very narrow interpretation of what faith would do, from my perspective.
Okay. Where might their definition of faith come from?
Well, hopefully the Bible.
The Bible. Or could we all agree that maybe the Bible is an important source for the thinking about Christian theology?
Amen, Steve.
Yeah. So on the one end, we have the Bible. But the Bible also says, for God, all things are possible. You have a 15-month-old child. She's crying. She's fussing. All things are possible for God. Is that what the Bible tells you? Some thoughts?
They're not God.
They're not God? Okay. But they have faith in God. We as Christians trust in God's promise. And one element of the promise is that for God, all things are possible. Yes?
But something you can infer from faith healing not working is that your faith somehow wasn't strong enough, and that's why your child died, or they didn't get over cancer, or something like that.
Everyone hear that? That it had less to do with God and had more to do with the faithful.
There are, God has also given us a brain to use. I mean, our faith is important. There's times we have to go with medicine we believe will help our child.
Okay. So can I say another source for thinking about bioethics has to do with human capabilities, human thinking?
But this comes from God.
Okay. Take it to its extreme. I mean, when your baby's hungry, you really, why would you feed it? Because God would provide.
Well, actually, taking to its extreme, and I read this somewhere, that there was a conference on children, and it was a number of Christians, including a Mennonite, and someone asked the panel, why have children? Especially if you're Mennonite. Mennonite believe in martyrdom. Martyrdom is the point of Christian life. You martyr yourself because Christ was born. So if the end of Christianity for Mennonites is death, why have children?
Why bring them into this world of sin and corruption and suffering? That's a Christian perspective. Other thoughts in terms of 15-month-old child? Yes?
Well, I mean, sometimes the answer is no, but you ask for something, the answer is no. The healing doesn't happen, but the faith is still there. People talk about the faith getting them through the pain, through the opening community, building relationships in ways that wouldn't have been there without the horrible thing. And it's not saying, oh, good, we had to have the horrible thing happen. Build those, but it's the faith that helped them through that horribleness. It didn't solve the problem.
Okay. Yes.
Well, I was struck by the quote there, we didn't know how sick she was. Anybody who's raised kids knows that there will be multiple times when you agonize over whether it's time to call for medical help or not.
So there it's about lack of knowledge or the inability to recognize the depth of someone's illness.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. Well, without belaboring those points, I want to talk about some of the things we brought up that I haven't really pushed you on yet. And my job, I think, this week is to push you, whether you like it or not. We've talked about faith. We've talked about the Bible. And I think it's fair to say that Jesus never really talked about genetics. Jesus talks more about poverty and the difficulty of being a Christian and being wealthy than anything else. Paul doesn't talk about physical health. In fact, most scholars of Paul believe that Paul was expecting that Jesus would return in Paul's lifetime. So if you expect Jesus to come back, guess what you're talking about? Be steadfast in faith. Do not worry about your body. Well, I'll talk about that. But there's also parts of the Bible that I think give us a sense of what is important for Christians. And I think you're right that a source for thinking about what is the value of human life is the Bible. But Lutherans have this beautiful idea of the living word. And what I want us to sort of think about is the fact that on the one hand you have the Bible, and on the other hand you have tradition. The tradition informs how you read the Bible. Behind tradition, you also have things like human reason, which you pointed out, that humans think. Humans interact with a text. And behind this is the idea of the living word. It is able to be made new within new contexts and for new problems. So even though there's a fundamental ambiguity about sort of the lack of a clear definition, there is no principle saying, in this situation, do this. You know, if your baby is sort of sick, bring them to the hospital. There is no simple answer. So we as Christians, and we as Lutherans in particular, are forced in some ways to accept our vocation as trying to discern God's will in these types of situations. What is Christian bioethics? So on the one hand, in the Bible, we have this passage, and this is formative for a lot of ethical deliberations. And I'll read it. And it's from Genesis 1:27 and 1:28. So God created humankind in God's image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." Now, the tradition that we're a part of, and it's broader than just the Lutheran, uses better pens than this one. This idea is we are created in the image of God. In fact, I just found this out the other day, that Mennonites and Amish and Anabaptists, they don't shave because they believe that it mars the image of God. That men's facial hair is a sign of the image of God. So you have this image of God. Well, what does it mean?
You shouldn't
shouldn't tinker with it. Okay. Well, what I'm also pointing out here is that you have this source, and you have a tradition that interprets it, this circle effect. So no clear answers. Okay, so you would say that one element of the image of God is we don't tinker it. But what is the image of God?
Relationality.
Relationality, yes, I think that's right. In a lot of ways, and I'm going to do it this way, that God has created an end for us. We have a point to our existence. What's the point of our existence? To relate to God. In fact, we think of the word communion here. We're asked to commune with God with what we do. We're essentially related to God, just as I'm essentially related to my parents. Some other thoughts, other elements that we might think about in terms of what the image of God is. Yes?
To be compassionate as God is compassionate?
I think that's one way to also think about that, if I can make an interpretation, that we receive value from having the image of God imprinted in us. That value says that, guess what? We are all equal as creatures. Independently of our capacities, of our ability to sing, our ability to play the piano, our ability to think, that every one of us is radically equal. Because all of us have this image of God imprinted in us. There's no differentiation with that. There's value inscribed in this sort of tradition. Yes?
Would this be a traditional interpretation of a modern tradition?
This is a traditional interpretation. This is
because thousands of years ago, no notion of equality as an image of God that I could understand, that I know of.
It's Paul talks about the image of God, and it comes largely through a thinker like Thomas Aquinas, who fuses Christian theology with Greek philosophy. And the way to do that is to say we're all unique. How do we know we're special? It's because we read Genesis, and Genesis tells us that we're all related to God because of the image of God that's inside of us. Part of the issue that I read too is the more modern interpretation: be fruitful and multiply, have dominion over the creatures of the sea and the air. Dominion has been problematic within Christian theology over the past 2,000 years as Christian theology developed. So, but we're all radically equal. That makes sense? So, any other thoughts? Yes.
Well, God says everything that God created is good. We already have dominion over things. That doesn't necessarily mean we can go in and, you know, waste away everything God has made. We have to be good stewards of what God has made.
That's absolutely right. That not only is there an end to our existence, there's also value, but there's also what I'm going to call a context. And what's the context? It's exactly what you're pointing out, that we are asked to have dominion, which nowadays is interpreted as stewardship, that we are part of nature. Nature is not separate. Nature is not something we can just objectify and use. Instead, nature is something that's inscribed also through God's creativity and relates essentially to our image of God in us. So I'm going to put stewardship here.
But that certainly was not the thought hundreds of years ago.
No.
Stewardship.
Nope.
Dominion. Taking control.
This is a modern movement. This is a movement over the last 100 and some years. And there's some other things that I'm going to push, hopefully, in about 5 minutes that I think relate to your question, too. That relate to bioethics.
Taking care of our bodies.
Well, yeah, Paul talks about temples, but we'll get to that in a second. How about that? So on the one hand, you have, let's say, the image of God as a basis for thinking about the worth of physical life. That it's valuable in that sense. And there's another element that's part of the Christian tradition. Sin. Good times with sin. Sin is actually one of those concepts that a lot of Christian theologians today don't like to deal with either. They come up with terms like anxiety, despair, sickness, disease, restlessness, because it connotates something and most people associate with sort of original sin. So, yes?
There's a different interpretation of sin now, about lack of, not instead of doing something bad, it's not being in relationship with.
And I think that's right. I think that the sin has to do with, if this is the image we are created to be, and with all of us equally sort of being expected to relate to God, then guess what? That sin is the breakage of that communion. So it's about relating. So we could say it's a misrelation. Any other quick thoughts about sin? I also want to suggest that when it relates to bioethics, that it's also interpreted as a couple other things. One is, let's say, the law of unintended consequences. That if sin has corrupted us, that we are misrelating to God, we're not in that sort of perfect harmony that we were once in. But also, that means we ourselves have been corrupted, necessitating Christ, frankly. Well, if that's the case, then guess what? We lack foreknowledge. We can't see the future. So you develop genetic tests to screen babies for certain types of genetic predispositions. What are people going to... You do it with the best intention. What might people use genetic prenatal testing for?
Abortion?
Males only? I mean, now you're starting to talk about the sort of geneticists that you can design babies. You can design physical features, you can design hair color, you can design eye color. And that if they don't fit the proper image of what you want your child to be, guess what? You can terminate pregnancy. So we lack foreknowledge.
I'm not sure how you're saying that's sin. I'm not following you there.
Part of it, think about it this way, that how about this example? CPR. CPR was invented primarily, for instance, to help patients who were victims of drowning, to bring them back to life. Today in the hospital, you have to ask the doctor not to resuscitate you. They will resuscitate you. Well, here is a good CPR that the sort of inventor of CPR was hoping would be used in certain situations, not to prolong life even after the brain is dead. And yet it's being used to keep people alive physically who are sort of brain dead. So the use of what could be a good and the intention of the creator of CPR is to use it as a good is not being used in the same way that the creator had intention. Does that make more sense or no?
Not working for me, but that's okay. I'm often slow.
My wife saying it doesn't make sense either.
Could it be that, our lack of foreknowledge is not in itself a sin, but it means that we're lacking one barrier to overstepping? I mean, it opens the way, our lack of foreknowledge opens the way to error in bioethics?
I mean, the way it's used in this context is that sin has corrupted us, and as a consequence, even though we think we're doing something good, that the likelihood that it is going to be misused or misappropriated is great because of sin's corruption of us. If we didn't have sin, we wouldn't lack foreknowledge, but we wouldn't need it because we would be in the state God had created us. We would have been still communing with God. Is this still problematic?
Well, it seems like with sin most of the time, think of it as something that we do or that's a choice. But a lack of foreknowledge seems to be something that's God-given that we don't have a choice of. I mean, I can't see the future. Is that original? I mean, if God wanted me to be able to see the future, wouldn't, I mean, that doesn't seem like usually when we talk about sin, right, like it's an action or something that I'm actively doing that's putting me in misrelationship with God. But it doesn't seem like not possessing the ability to see the future has anything to do with, right?
Yeah. Let me try this. Yeah. That there's two ways to think about sin, and both are appropriate in these kinds of conversation. One, sin is an action. I don't love my neighbor as I should. Two, sin is a state. It's a condition that's a bad analogy. It's your genetic makeup. It's a state of being. And within the Lutheran tradition, this is what's often emphasized. I mean, for instance, Luther felt that you could never get past selfishness. I mean, Luther every day said, every day is the same struggle to relate to God properly. You get up, guess what? You're still screwing up in God's eyes. That's why you need Christ. That's why you're justified by faith alone. So it's a state, not just an action.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. I don't understand how, I never thought of us as humans, if we were not sinful, that we have foreknowledge. That just doesn't seem, I've never considered that option. I've never heard that ever said as something that we should have.
Okay.
Maybe it's that we don't recognize that we don't have foreknowledge, and we recognize the limitations of that bring, and we make decisions without taking that into account.
Yeah, let me explain it this way too. This comes out of a read of original sin as a sort of a mythic tale of our origins, not as a literal sort of day-by-day account of exactly what happened. Would Adam and Eve needed anything in that original state? Did they have knowledge of good and evil?
No.
So not they didn't have foreknowledge. They didn't have knowledge at all. In fact, they were ignorant. In fact, part of the Jewish tradition reads that story as the beginning of knowledge, the beginning of culture. Without original sin, we wouldn't have Picasso. We wouldn't have Max. We wouldn't have computer chips. We wouldn't have Holden in some ways. We wouldn't need it because everything was perfect. We were in that state of being right with God. Well, this view, and again, I'm pushing this because it's important to how bioethicists define sort of the problems, for instance, with genetic testing. You have to be suspicious, because guess what? Someone's going to try and profit from genetic engineering. It leads to sort of a real ambiguity that we're not wholly good, and just because we want to make, you know, atoms for peace doesn't mean we're only going to use nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. People don't sort of recognize, or you don't know what's going to happen with the technology that you throw out there.
So what you're getting at is intentional and unintentional.
That's another way to think about it. Sure.
So you're not saying that lack of foreknowledge is sin in general, but in the realm of bioethics, because we don't know what future consequences will be. I mean, that's why I'm generalizing this lack of foreknowledge to all things, and that's where I'm being hung up. I can see what you're saying by in the field of bioethics, I can see where you're going.
Okay. How about we leave it at that?
Yeah.
Because it Is that okay?
In my daily
in your analogy, it would seem to me that a human being can never make fully correct judgment.
Right.
So, sin permeates everything. That means even when I'm doing something good, I might not be, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there is no clarity of human action. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. Everyone hear that? No clarity of human action.
Well, one of the ways that we can deal with that, though, is we have technology, but we also have institutions which aren't necessarily perfect, but we have like, colleges of physicians and philosophers and ethicists and, you know, religious people who consider the consequences. And they aren't always right, but, you know, it's an effort to, use the reason that we've been given.
So you trust that they're almost like a check and balance system.
Sure, yeah.
That, for instance, with human cloning, no one on the island of Fiji is going to get the technology off the internet and decide to clone a human.
Probably.
Even though it's illegal in most Western countries. And that's part of the issue with bioethics, too, is technology. And that's what we're talking tomorrow about, technology and sort of can we keep Pandora's box closed when it comes to this kind of stuff. But yes, well, I'll have to come up with a better analogy for that. let me quickly move on to two other ideas of sort of the sources for thinking about bioethics. One is a theology of creation. And this tells us a lot about God. And I think this is what I was partially pushing with the idea for God, all things are possible. But with the theology of creation, the traditional view is that God created out of nothing. So there was nothing, there was a void, and God spoke. Well, God created. But did God create necessarily? Did God have to create us?
Don't know.
Christians argue, for the most part, that it was not necessary, but it was an act of divine love. Which means love sort of permeates creation, because there's really no point to creation, then why would God do it? And Christians suggest that if we read the Bible and read the text and interpret it, this is a long-standing tradition, that it's out of God's love.
Is that a faith concept?
Yeah.
That is a little tricky, right?
Yeah. All these are tricky. I mean, frankly, we could spend a whole day just on this, but I only have 4 days, so. And I only right now have 25 minutes. Well, there's also the view that, and this is part of the contentious debate now, and I'm going to spell this wrong, continuous. All right? Yeah. That God is active with creation today. And Christians often use the idea of spirit. God was there at the beginning, will be there tomorrow. God is active through the Spirit. Jesus was brought forth to restore the problem with creation. There you have sort of the understanding of the Trinity, which itself isn't even in the Bible. It's a later tradition. It didn't pop up for about 400 years. People are still debating what it is. And this is now a more non-traditional reading. This gets back to an assumption both about the state of sin, but also with human power. Can humans create things that are good? Well, then humans also have a creative function, too. In many ways, you could say that the image of God is, as a creator, that if we're created in God's image, then we, too, have creative powers. Often this is described as humans as co-creators alongside of God. Because part of the issue here is where does God's power end and human power begin? I mean, there are lots of different Christian traditions. And many of them suggest that humans don't have creative power. Any form of human creativity is full of pride. It's telling God that we don't need God. Dear God, I have a nice cushy bed. I have yummy food. I have clothes that I can change into whenever I want. I don't need you. I mean, that's what asceticism is all about. It's viewing that you get back to the bare minimum, to the point you deny your body, so that you can properly relate to God. Clearly, they don't worry about co-creation. If, however, humans do have the ability to create something good, that means that human culture, human technology, medical advances are all partially both created by humans, but they're gifts from God. Genetic screening is then a gift from God. Heart transplants, organ transplants, life-saving techniques then are partially gifts from God. And this is a move that's been made within about the last 150 years. Partially because the concern is, well, are we stomping on God's toes? If God is the creator, if our life has utterly dependent on God's will and God's intention, then why should we do anything? This view says that it's not a competition, but more like degrees, if you would think of circles, that God sort of ultimately is this centerpiece that sort of grounds everything, and we're all creating around it, only because this is here. Only because God has created can we create. So, how about that? Does that make sense? Again, this is important because of how we think about bioethics. And there's one other source I haven't mentioned. Any thoughts? It's in the title. Sort of. Well,
biology.
How about Christ? I think Christ is kind of important. Well, that fell flat. Then we have Christ. And we've talked about God's activity as creator. We've talked about our sort of state of being sort of suspiciously. We lack a real ability to predict what our future is going to be and how we're going to use technology. Well, then we have Christ. Any thoughts on Christ? He's all right with you? I'll look for that. Why is Christ important? Well, on the one hand, I want to suggest that we think about him as an ideal to strive for. The Lutheran tradition will say you strive every day, you actually never get there. But nonetheless, the point of faith is to strive every day. The ideal being someone who suffers, someone who is constantly concerned with the other, with the neighbor, with love. So in a lot of ways, Christ then gives us a sense of what a just life is. What is a good life? This is the ethical part in many ways. That God has given us power. God has given us the power to create. God has given us the power to build marvelous things. But how do we use them? This is sort of fundamental then. Not only is Christ the ideal, he's the basis for a right relation to God within Lutheran Christianity. How? Well, you have the cross. And through the cross, we are made right with God. Through the cross and the resurrection. Christ, then, is fundamental for how we think about human life, because Christ gives us this idea of justice. How are we to act towards each other? Christ also, and this is, Christ suffers, but Christ suffers to end suffering. that also comes into play when talking about medical ethics, because guess what? People suffer. People suffer. So, okay, are we, some of these traditions here, the resources we have at hand, and some ideas? So, and what I want to talk about now is what I was also hoping to put up on the board. But I wanted to think about the problem we face as Christians today. Because we don't live in a perfect Christian society, and I'm not arguing for a theocracy, judgment. The difficulty becomes how we negotiate and understand the values that help us make decisions about life and physical life. And once I get this up, and the way I want us to think about it, because we have to deliberate, that there is a continuum of value. And I'm going to spell this wrong too. It looks weird with two U's. And we, as Christians, are sort of part of two worlds. And often those worlds don't necessarily fit together harmoniously. And those worlds of different values then challenge us. They challenge us to make sense of our own values. They challenge us to make sense of others' values. They challenge us to appreciate what God has given us. But most importantly, I think our calling as Christians then is to discern what we value. And I want to point out some sort of tensions. And I think these are dynamic tensions. I don't necessarily think these are in conflict. But they do come into conflict when you think about bioethical decisions. And on the one hand, you have sort of a dominant cultural trend in our world of the focus is on the individual. There's a sense of autonomy. Each of you should make a living will. You, yourself, have told other people, I want to die under these circumstances. I do not want to be resuscitated. So there's a sense of autonomy, and there's a focus on the particular person. Well, we as Christians are called into the body of Christ. So essentially, we are part of something greater than ourselves. And this is especially true through baptism. We are called to be something greater than ourselves. Well, the problem becomes that, again, we are both, I'm a citizen of Minnesota. I'm also a member of Bethel Lutheran Church. How do I negotiate between being both an individual and being part of something greater than myself called the body of Christ that is everywhere and in every place and every time? How do I negotiate these two? Especially when it comes to bioethics. The choices we make as individuals, I'm not going to give my organs to someone else. Affect even not just the Christian community, but the community as a whole. But a sort of prevailing tenet of our society is the focus on the individual. There's also a tendency to think about people as means. And a lot of bioethical debate is based in sort of a consequentialist ethic, which means the best outcome is the action one should take. I always think of Spock and Wrath of Khan. He's goes like this in the dilithium crystal chamber and says, "Is the ship out of danger, Jim?" And then he says, "The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few." He is a means to protect other people. He's sacrificing himself. Well, how does that play out in medical ethics? for instance, should, and I think of what, my sister's keeper, where a family has a child so that they can harvest her organs for their older sister who's dying. Will we get to the point with bioethics where we will clone people just so that we can harvest their organs? That's a real ethical issue right now in terms of cloning. It's one of the real, obviously, negative, but I can imagine someone who wants to make money. I mean, already there's a tremendous sort of black market in organ donation. The corruption case in New Jersey?
Yeah, the rabbis who are involved. Yeah,
they're transporting organs. Well, if you could build it in a test tube. So. There's also the problem of the quantification of life versus, I didn't say end. Should I say something about the end? The view of ends, and the most radical view of the end, is that every element of human life is sacred. Roman Catholicism, for instance. Why don't you use birth control?
Every sperm is sacred.
Every sperm is sacred. Every sperm is sacred. And the basis for that argument is the image of God. That everything has the image of God imprinted in it. So we have that's quantification. And I'll just put on quant. Or non-quant. On the one hand, will we ever say that human life has a monetary value? Yeah.
Don't we do it already with insurance? I mean, it's de facto.
Well, we as Christians, is that necessarily what we value?
I have a son who works in a medical facility, and he often shakes his head about families that want everything done for this person who is 90 years old and probably will not have decent quality of life, but still they want everything done. And I think, isn't there statistics that the greatest expense in medical is at the end of life? So, I mean, you're just prolonging the inevitable.
That's a good point.
What's the point?
They say 80% of one's healthcare costs, or 80% of Americans' healthcare costs as a whole, is used by 20% of the population. And the median age is in the 70s for the 20. Well, I mean,
why stop at 90? Why not go say, well, let's stop at 60?
No, I mean,
you know, I'm saying that's the slippery slope you go on. When I don't defend that, but I mean, that's the slope you go on when you say, well, this is where we'll cut it. If you're over 90, too bad.
No, there's common sense in this. What was your quality?
If there was
life?
Common sense, I'd be out of a job. But it's a good point. I mean, part of it is, what do we think of life in this sense? Is it something we can assign a monetary value to? I mean, sort of traditional Christian is no. Again, if it's life is sacred, like every element of life, even if you don't necessarily believe that every element of life is sacred. For Lutheran Church, for instance, it affirms that sex is more than just procreation. Brings the couple closer together, brings about joy, it sort of enacts the type of love that God has given us. If that's the case, then the Lutheran stance then on sacredness is it's less totalitarian, it's a bad word, than the Roman Catholic position. So, but then how do we quantify life? Yeah.
But also, is life just electricity going across my synapses and my heart beating? Or, I mean, if I have those things, I could be said to be alive, but what if I'm not in a condition to be relational with God or with anybody else? Or or even conscious of my own existence, I mean, is that life?
You bring up a great point. I mean, part of it has to do with what you think life is. And, you know, there's a lot, there's, you know, the God delusion, I don't know if anyone's familiar with that book. There's the selfish gene. There's a lot of work been done by evolutionary psychologists that, among other things, suggest that, for instance, by nature we're selfish. But we become selfish for our tribe. And I think this would be interesting to have a conversation with Carla this morning, but with sort of an evolutionary perspective. Because what the assumption is that by protecting your tribe, guess what you're doing? You're ensuring that your genes will continue. And the belief is that ultimately all we are is sort of the spreading of our genes within the evolutionary perspective.
Better?
Yeah.
Looking at the monetary value of life, if you could say how much life is worth by how much it costs to get rid of, the death penalty is now averaging somewhere between $1 and $2 million per person to kill them. So the end of life costs, in public policy, we're willing to pay up to, in some cases, $5 million to kill somebody. So that's a kind of interesting way
sort of flipping the,
yeah,
the
right,
question.
How you look at how much life is worth.
The view I'm here there is sort of an assumption of, are we just material neurological firings? We're just sort of atoms. Or are we something more? Are we a soul? Are we spiritual? Any thoughts on that question? Yes.
I think that spiritual is tied to your example. If we don't recognize that death is a part of life, life has a beginning, life has, life on this earth has an end, and when we pass into the next life, you know, do we value that? Is that something, are we afraid of the unknown of the next life?
Have you ever heard of the Methuselah Society?
No.
It's a group of people who want to bring, who want to extend life indefinitely in a very qualitatively positive way. And that was a question that's often raised to them, like, don't you think that death is as important as living forever? And
well,
they don't think so.
I read somewhere recently that Kurzweiler, who's the inventor of the synthesizer, he is now trying to develop a means to transfer his self-consciousness into some type of mechanical machine so that he could, his self-consciousness can live indefinitely. Which sort of raises questions about whether the self-consciousness is material. In his view, I think it's more material because guess what? You can reproduce it with mechanical means. So. Some other assumptions are that all we have is Earth. And a more radical sort of Christian perspective is all we have is heaven. Don't worry about your bodies. Here, all you have is your body. Fix it. Here, heaven is your home. Your life is just sort of twiddling your thumbs until you actually pass into the night. And I'll say one more thing. There also is, let's say, the opposite of sin, a trust in human powers and capacity.
Opposite of sin?
The opposite of sin, yes. Oh. With the opposite sort of tension being sort of the view that everything we do is corrupted. So here, science does provide the answers. It provides truth. It provides the ability to make your life better. And we don't need to really worry about the consequences of such actions. We don't have to be suspicious. This is heavily the
Enlightenment, for instance, had a very high view of human capacity and human creativity and human thinking. And they actually believed and sort of gleaned on to Newton that we would discover the laws that ran everything. And if you've discovered the laws that ran everything, you could perfect society. Well, the last 50 years, because of things like the Holocaust and the atom bomb, have been dealing with the demise of that perspective. And many of them have become sort of nihilistic. I don't know if any, like postmodernism or deconstructionism. They basically say there is no truth, and we're sort of, you just choose something randomly. Any questions?
How many answers?
Well, but,
I do have a question.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if at the end of 4 or 5 sessions, we'll come to any conclusion other than that. Well, let me preface by saying early on you threw out, had kind of a throwaway remark about you weren't arguing for a theocracy. And given the way the discussion seems to be heading, and given my thoughts on some of this, it seems to me that you can't argue Christian bioethics in a public forum without creating some sort of theocracy. So is that going to come out in the discussion as we move along?
Well, what I was doing today with the idea of foundations is that I wanted to come up with this, and it was going to be up here with more detail, but we can't figure out how to put my Mac onto the projector. And we would use this to talk about genetics tomorrow, euthanasia on Wednesday, and on Friday healthcare, or Thursday on healthcare. So part of it is there are no easy answers to the questions about bioethics. And we're trapped, I think, as Americans and Christians between these kind of various perspectives. And I, in my personal opinion, no one's completely over here. And no one's completely over here. But what we need to do as Christians is sort of discern where we fit on these types of dynamic continuums. What are our values? How do we then make sense of end-of-life decisions? How do we make sense of genetic testing? How do we make sense of faith healing? So today it's less about the answer and more about thinking about ways we can talk about it the rest of with me giving a short summary every day of this, whether that would actually work. Maybe I always try too much, but Carol?
Well, back to when you were talking about how does Christ fit into this, or how does the Christian part of bioethics emerge, I think that maybe, Christ has the place in our lives and in our world of being the center of the possibility of newness and transformation. And I wonder if maybe that can help to frame our discussion of, or can make bioethics, Christian bioethics, somewhat different in that we, in just talking about it, we also are bringing in that possibility of transformation that goes beyond parsing out the different, all the details that make it possible for us to find the exact right answer to these questions. And I'm just trying to think of the way that
I think that's a good point. I guess the question I would ask you, are there answers? Is there an answer? Or is it more about us as a community coming together, as the body of Christ, using sort of that ideal of Christ and the gifts God has given us to talk about these so that we can sort of discern better answers, as opposed to the answer or the principle to answer those types of questions. Those kinds of conversations and deliberations. I don't know if that's helpful, but any other questions? It's gotten hot in here.